there's a tendency within me to want to cover things that aren't here, because this, it used to be a bigger lecture, it's like about 7 pages long. So I'm trying my best not to do that. If, when I do, if you're thinking, is that going to be on a quiz? Usually not. Usually the stuff that isn't on the sheet is not, but if it's just really good stuff central to it, then, and I feel like, you know, I'll try to stress what you don't have to worry about when I get off on tangents. Let's talk about how Rhode Island came into being. It has to do with people who dissented against the Massachusetts colony. Massachusetts was made up of dissenters, of course, dissenters who had closed the Anglican Church. But what the message of Rhode Island, Massachusetts was supposed to be, that now that we have escaped the corruption of the Anglican Church, and now that we're establishing the perfect role model community, there is no need for any further criticism or dissension. It's just not the way others see it, because other community elders saw it. And not to make a parallel between Marxists and Puritans, not making that parallel, it just reminds me a little bit of the Soviet Union, complaining about how it had thrown off the vestiges of the czarist system, of capitalist system, of bourgeois idealism, and after the came of the Soviet state, that's the perfect state. They don't tolerate or have any trust with any further criticism, so people who were critics either went to Siberia or went to mental institutions. I'm not saying that that's what Puritans did, I don't mean that at all, but the attitude was somewhat similar, that now that we have made the proper correction, get with the program or else there is something wrong with you. Two people who ran afoul of Massachusetts Bay Colony policies were Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson. So did I mention them at all, or is this where we are? So let's talk about their circumstances. Both of them were critical of blue laws, both were critical of how much overlap existed between church leadership and government leadership and people occupying the same role, making policies for both. Start with a little bit off that topic. Williams complained that the killing of Indians and stealing their land was not a good plan at all, because as he argued, what if the Indians, some of them may be the elect, God's not going to be impressed. But it was a quick retort to that when many people said back, now Roger, you know better than that. How can they be the elect? They're Indians. So that was their quick response to that. But the more, and it would show later how much, how tolerant, open-minded, and negotiable he was with Native Americans in Rhode Island. What his major criticism was this. If you make it a law, if you make the police responsible, state government responsible for enforcing behavioral codes, then what does that say about the message of the minister? Or put it another way, the message on Sunday is we as a community should not do the following things, and we should do the following things, and then along under the law on Monday through Saturday is backed it up. Roger Williams said that. That sends what message about the church? Well, they're not very persuasive. They're not reaching the community. That when you have to use the threat of law to try to reach what should have been from the heart, you disgrace the church, and you destroy its dignity, and you destroy its authority. So he argued, in order to protect and defend the church, we need to separate church and state and let the government pave roads, pay for defense, etc., and let the church be responsible for ethical and moral community behavior. Thus he would have thrown out blue laws, etc. Well, the church elders, who are also realists, know it's kind of like someone going to an assistant principal and saying, let's have open campus at the high schools and give us an hour for lunch. They're responsible for all the people being wrecked and late and lost and everything else. So since human beings are, in the eyes of Calvinists, depraved folk, you don't dare run that risk. They, in a pragmatic sense, if not power sense, didn't want to give up those rules and laws. And so Roger Williams was expelled from the college and went over and began to start what became the Rhode Island colony. Later to be joined by Anne Hutchinson. And she too was a critic of the fusion of church and state. It's become popular in the recent 20, 25 years to argue that the reason Anne Hutchinson became a significant figure as well as a persecuted and expelled figure was because she was an uppity woman who was throwing weight around in a man's world. while there may be a case to be made for that, that flavor, that way of describing Hatchison is a new revisionist historical viewpoint. You don't see that before the 60s. You just see her as a religious dissenter. So it's kind of, I find that interesting in the realms of, it could have been the case and not emphasized in the past, or it could be an overly emphasized new left way of looking at history. Nonetheless, here's her circumstance. She would go to the sermons on Sunday, and then on Monday through Friday hold like rebroadcasts in her home. Let's have Bible meetings, we're going to go back over what was the sermon on Sunday. And on Monday, Tuesday, it was pretty close to what was on Sunday, but by Friday, it had been twisted around to what should have been said last Sunday, according to Ann Hutchinson. And that, of course, didn't set well with John Winthrop, who was church leader as well as, if not always the governor, the influential person behind the change in governors in Massachusetts. But, and what she would argue is that, again, a criticism of blue laws, criticism of behavioral codes by the state, she would say, if people behave themselves and don't drink and don't gamble and don't go chase all that stuff because the law says so, and do so for many, many years, what signal, what mistaken message might they get after a lifetime of living according to the community laws, which are also the church laws?
That's correct.
That they're going to be saved because of their deeds, because of their actions, which is a fallacy, it's a mistake, it's a heresy, because salvation was already determined well before anybody was born. So their actions to live a pious, proper, moral lifestyle should have been because that's their obligation to the possibility that they may be saved. Now, one really supposedly knew until the very end, almost like church elders have a good hand. But I guess a more humble person would wait to the final moment of life and still always feel a debt of possible, a gratitude for the possibility of being saved. So if people follow according to the law, they're going to maybe get the wrong message that you earned salvation. And in fact, we will see later in colonial turning into early nation history of religion, that is exactly what happens theologically. That a lot of people in New England began to modify the view that yes, it's salvation by grace, but in special extenuating circumstances, those people who just really distinguish themselves and press the Lord and do earn salvation. That's not the colonial theory now, but it will come later after independence. So her argument was, again, disgracing the church, destroying the method, but the message, you should give away all laws or disband all the laws that regulate moral behavior. St. Robinson of Rogers, so she was kicked out. She competed with Roger Williams for the charter to be the proprietor of the Rhode Island colony, and he got it. She didn't. He became the owner of the colony. After that, she moved on with her family to Long Island, New York, where one night was slaughtered, all of them were killed by Indians. And the message came back to John Winthrop what had happened to Ann Hutchinson. His only response was, "The hand of God in you." So there were power struggles, and there were problems, and people migrated out of Massachusetts because they were not in harmony with either specific leaders or attitudes and policies in Massachusetts Bay. This is true for the people who moved to Connecticut and Rhode Island. Two migrations to Connecticut. One involved people who thought the church was too strict and needed to be more lax, and those who thought the church had already become too defiled and corrupt and needed to be strict. But nonetheless, all the people moving into New England coming out of the Massachusetts Bay or Massachusetts itself colony area. Rhode Island at times was known as Rogue's Island because it seemed to accept just everybody, whether they were a different religion or no religion. And it is true that sometimes people that can't seem to follow authority, it's not always authority's fault. Rhode Island became a haven for thieves and robbers and kind of things too. But it's famous for that. Most of the money made in the New England colony came from these industries here, harvesting lumber for shipbuilding, shipping overseas trading, and dairy farming. So we're now ready to move to the middle colonies. Middle colonies are all those from New York down to Maryland. Will that include Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and on occasions, the northern section of Delaware. They're classified middle colonies mainly because of their economics, which is they're the breadbasket grain-growing region of the area, producing wheat, corn, millet, barley, thank goodness for barley. They're also engaged in shipping trade, New York City becoming the most prominent city for that. Fur trade with Native Americans. It was the most cosmopolitan region, meaning it drew people from the most diverse backgrounds. Especially Pennsylvania, we'll explain why when we start talking about Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania drew religious dissenters from all parts of Europe. Here are people you don't want to know for a quiz, but people like Anabaptists, Dunkers, Moravians, Mennonites, Amish. This, throughout the colonial and the early nation period, these Protestant dissenters of Europe, Holland and Germany, migrated to Pennsylvania because it's such an open, tolerable climate. And the reason why is because it's based on originally Quaker settlement. In fact, let me talk a little bit about Pennsylvania's founding. Let's go into rest mode. Here's a bit of a story that you don't have to worry about for a test, and we'll shift back over to now write this down. In 1649, in the late 1640s, culminating in 1649, an English Civil War came to a close when Puritan Roundhead leaders of the Parliament overtook and defeated the royal forces of Charles I with Cassel. And from 1649 to 1660, there was no monarch of England. And Parliament ruled under Oliver Cromwell, leader of the Puritan faction. And during those years, it was the Puritans' target and goal and mission to clean up England, close down the brothels, close down the theaters, close down the bars, and try to do to England essentially what was going on in Massachusetts Bay. English weren't impressed, and so eventually they restored the monarchy power over to the Puritan control. So Charles II was brought back to the throne in 1660. And when he did so, he had some debts to repay for the people who helped him come back to power. Two categorical ways to pay back debts. One was to aristocratic, in addition to one of them, that aristocratic noblemen who had been responsible for bringing him to power, he owed them money, large amounts of money, as well as favors and loans that had come from bankers and businessmen. So here's the two categorical ways that he pays back Charles II. Pays back his debt for restoration. To certain aristocrats, he grants land colonies in the New World. To merchants and businessmen, he shepherds through Parliament the first mercantile navigation laws. Pennsylvania was one of those kind of colonies. It was a colony given to an aristocrat who he owed money to for being a source of power, William Penn Sr. Close friend of mine. William Penn's son, William Penn Jr., in his early years, had taken up with a counterculture to the people in England called Quakers. Quakers believed that all people were equal, all races, all genders, that there should be no hierarchy whatsoever over people. All people were directly connected to God, had a spark of divinity within them. I'm sure that's the stuff. And it'll stop on its own?
I have no idea. I'm just asking that left up there.
They're all of you. And because of that connection to God, that direct connection to God, it implied that all could be saved. So if every single person has a direct connection to God and can communicate directly and be saved, and in fact does get saved through working upon that conversation. How would you contrast the Quakers to the Puritans? Yeah, quite the opposite. That all people can be saved, therefore all people are essentially good rather than depraved. And in England, the Quakers were, as I said, disrespectful towards social status and authority. They wore drab, kind of like Gothic today, clothes and all of that. Purposely wanting to show a lack of respect for the upper crust. Didn't want to pay taxes to the military, because the military kills people, all people are equal, so shouldn't we kill them? And so when Penn Jr. joined up with this kind of hippie radical crowd, his father was embarrassed, and sent him off to Cambridge University to get him away from his youth. And it worked. He dropped his ties to the Quakers, graduated Cambridge, came back, took his place as the dutiful heir to the property. Then the father died. William Penn Jr. inherited all the property and money and went right back to his Quaker buddies. Now it's one. So the debt that was owed to the family was not owed to the son, but owed to the father. But it was paid to the son after the father passed, a colony in the New World. And Penn decided to make that colony a haven for Quakers. And being as ecumenical as Quaker faith is, he really implied it was going to be a haven for all religious disciples, which that's why so many people from Europe moved there. And it's also one of the reasons why Pennsylvania grew to be the largest colony, Philadelphia the largest city before the Declaration of Independence. And it was such a mixture of people from all over different parts of Europe, languages and religions and attitudes and feelings. It's not surprising that it's in that cosmopolitan climate that's long been Franklin with the surface of the world. Although slavery did exist in Pennsylvania in the early years, the Quakers were the earliest and first to be abolitionists. Not surprising with their attitudes. And that is, and well, add to this, after the American Revolution, all the states from Pennsylvania northward abolished slavery, and all the states south maintained it. Now, it's pretty obvious that outside of Quakers and maybe Rhode Island, most people would have retained slavery if it had been profitable. So the abolition of slavery was probably something northerners bragged about, thinking themselves to be morally superior. But it's pretty obvious two things. One is, had it been more profitable, it wouldn't have been abolished so fast. And they still made a lot of money well up until probably the 1820s and 30s off of slavery, well, even the Civil War, off of cheaper labor and cheaper products in the worldwide trade. In the late 1600s, I think the 1680s is when Pennsylvania was discovered. In the late 1600s, two surveyors drew the boundary between Maryland and Pennsylvania. The boundary became not just two colonial boundaries, but a separation of middle and southern colonies. What's that line known as?
Mason-Dixon.
Exactly, Mason-Dixon line. Or Jeremiah Dixon and James Mason, the surveyors. And the Mason-Dixon line would come to mean separation of slave South from free North. And as the country grew westward, the term the Mason-Dixon line would continue to exist, but go far west in just those two colonies of states. It would go over the Ohio River, out to Missouri, and to some degree all the way out to the Panhandle of Texas, as it continued to define slave South and non-slave. And I think everything that we need to know for a quiz on the first sheet we covered, I have. Let's move to the second sheet, Southern Colonies. Which include Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, originally one Carolina that split into two, and Georgia. Once again, parts of the southern portion of Delaware fits into this. This is the one that's chronologically the most mixed up, because we can apply these things. Maryland was founded in 1632, Virginia in 1607, the Carolinas 1660s, Georgia in 1732. So cover these things chronologically, but just be jumping back and forth. What they have in common is the society and their agriculture. So the first one, Virginia, established in 1607. People who owned the Virginia colony stayed in England and sent others over to populate. I know all that was true for most colonial owners. I was thinking about how Massachusetts and the Plymouth people had. And the people that were sent over in this first venture to set up, first successful venture to set up a colony, actually were at one time from prominent families of aristocratic background who had generations before that spent away all their money and had no property left. So they still hang with the rich crowd just because of their birth and name and social status and feudalism, but they don't have the resources to party as hard as the others. So when they discover there's this attempt to plant a colony, some of these people volunteer to be the first colonists in the expectation that they'll come to Virginia, find gold, get rich, and go back and live simply. Which doesn't work out that way. Instead, they plant their colony on a marshy swamp, and malaria spreads, and quite a few people die. In the first 8 years of the Virginia colony, there's hundreds and hundreds of people migrating every year, rarely more than 100 to 200 people alive at the end of any 1 year. Had that knowledge got back to England, I don't think people would have come. So you have a lot of shiftless, oblivious people to how to survive in this climate. One of the colonists, John Smith, and this is a Don't Write Down, just a fun one. John Smith decides that if no one is going to take order and make this stuff work, he's just going to take a gun through martial law and make people start hunting, gathering, and farming. And a few refuse and shoot some, the others get the gun and they fall in line. And John Smith wrote an autobiography of himself, which he told a lot of lavish stories, probably a lot of stories, which included having been a mercenary soldier that was injured and left for dead on the battlefield of Turkey, nursed back to health by Turkish slave women who were enamored by him, sneaking back to England. And then he was a surveyor that put together much of the maps that people like the Pilgrims as well as Virginia colonists used to come to the New World. They explain why the Pilgrims trying to get Virginia ended up way up in Massachusetts on the wrong map. While exploring around the Virginia colony, the story has it that he was captured by neighboring Indians and was to be executed while his head was on the chopping block. He turned sideways, he looked himself, Pocahontas, and charmed him to the point that she begged her father to let him go. And then later his leg blew up in a powder keg explosion, so he decided to retire and went back to England. John Smith's story. The circumstance with Virginia is this. The people who came did not come for community or religious purposes, Massachusetts people did. They came to make money and make profit. And the people who owned the colony, who did not come, also wished to make profit off this. So you have, in essence, tenant farmers in this new world trying to make money off of tobacco, not cotton. Cotton wouldn't be real profitable after the 1790s, but tobacco. And what was the major barrier to profits in this new colony was the lack of labor. Feudalism in Europe was built around the notion that there was always far more people than there was land. And so everybody wanted land. You get to the New World and it's the reverse. There's far more land than there are people. So how to make your profits is to get more workers in. That's one of the reasons why they privatized the property and granted everybody who was in the first settlements some chunk of land so they themselves would be more industrious and productive and tried to finance others coming over. This is what gave rise to the indentured servant system, where people would be contracted to come to the New World and work. Two types of indentured servants, bonded and non-bonded. Bonded indentured servants were either like deserters of the Navy or people who, when they got caught stealing or killing or something, would be given a choice at the court. You can go to the prison where most of your food will come from family members and friends if you have any, or it won't. Or you can go over to the New World and work for a number of years for any of these people who are willing to fit you out for So that type of indentured servitude was just to avoid prison. They weren't guaranteed anything other than. The other type of indentured servitude is where people willingly contracted themselves into it. They signed a contract, certain provisions, number of years. Most of those contracts offered so much acreage of land at the end. They also usually offered a certain degree of human rights protection. What we find is that most of the indentured servants, whether they're bonded or not, when they finish their service, are given land and become well-to-do landowners themselves, financing other indentured servants. The first African laborer that came to Virginia in 1619 definitely was not in any kind of contract. It was, in essence, Dutch bought, purchased African slaves, but they were treated as indentured servants, and all the first ones that lived were granted freedom and some property. And while it was rare, it wasn't possible for there to be African landowners buying or financing indentured servants from Europe to work for a small number. After the 1660s, African labor became so much cheaper than indentured European labor that it didn't take long for people to realize, if I'm under no contract to free these people, why free them? And when you have a growing labor force that is one color rather than another, that is not with any rights or freedom, social status, social system evolved. So historians debate, was racial prejudice in place at the very first exposure to African labor, or did it grow as a result of losing freedom, losing status? And probably both. Maryland, let's talk about some of that Maryland. Established in 1632 by the Calvert family. George the father, Cecilius the son Calvert, both known as the Lords Baltimore. They were well-to-do aristocratic Catholics. Now, Catholics, by this time, this is a near century after the Reformation in England, Catholics were suspect people, never really considered fully trustable English citizens, probably waiting in the underground for the marching orders of the Pope to call on them. But those who had more property or those who were higher in status tended to be shielded from that kind of danger. And so that was the Calvert family. What they wanted to do was set up a colony in the New World, which would make them money, no doubt, but also provide a haven for Catholics. So that's what Maryland decided, to be a haven for Catholics. This didn't work out as they planned. They encouraged some migrants who were Catholics to come over, but it turns out that more Protestants, especially Puritans, moved into the Maryland colony than did Catholics. With the Calverts back in England, local government in the hands of those who were in the colonies, Puritans took over the legislature and threatened to pass a law outlawing Catholicism, the Calvert colony. It's at the same time that the 30 Years' War is raging in Europe, the struggle between Catholic and Protestant German states. So there is the anticipated fear that civil war and murder over religious differences in Europe are going to spill over to Maryland. But the interesting step in history is Protestants and Catholics in Maryland came to an agreement called the Act of Toleration, 1649 Act of Toleration, saying that it's just as simple as this. If you believe in Christ, you have the right to live and worship and practice in this colony. So it's hailed as one of the great steps of religious freedom and toleration. People overlook the fact that it said for Jews and atheists that execution was their plan. They didn't do it, they just put them in agreement. The Carolina colony was established in the 1660s. It is another one of those proprietary grants made by Charles II. To 8 different aristocrats that we owed a favor to. And I forgot to do New York on the previous page, but we'll go back to that. Carolina itself split into 2 colonies, north and south. The northern colony made most of its living off of growing tobacco and naval stores such as pitch tar and turpentine, and you have a lot of Virginia migrants moving in the northern part of the colony. it separates the 1729 from the south. The south is, well, it's all the way up to Civil War, South Carolina carries an extremist social attitude. And it's probably because of its southern. The first people to colonize South Carolina, the first foreign people to colonize, were slave owners of the Caribbean. Let's talk somewhat about this, the way slavery worked in the Caribbean. Of all the slaves brought to the New World, they first were brought into Caribbean ports, disembarked, and sent to South America, Central America, and North America. 96% of the slaves stayed in the tropics, Central South America. Only about 4 to 5% were sent up into the North American colonies. Those who made it up to the North American colonies usually lived out more of a natural life. Those who stayed in the Caribbean lived 2, 3, 4 years at best, because it was considered cheaper to work them to death and replace them than it was to keep them alive. So you're looking at not-to-death camp type conditions. The people who owned these slaves, or especially if they had to be right on the plantations running those things, became, as anybody would, should, jaded about their attitudes of life and said they needed a break. So they'd hire overseers to run these death camps in the Caribbean, move to South Carolina, buy more slaves, treat them more kindly, feel less guilty, or still own the plantation. These are the first people to settle South Carolina. South Carolina also got a wave of French immigrants, Protestants that were escaping persecution of the Catholic Church. And then the last colony to be established, the youngest at the time of the American Revolution, was Georgia, established in the 1730s. Again, here is a story that's not going to be on the quiz, so you don't have to write it down. But Georgia was a social experiment by a group of mercenary soldiers who had seen enough death, destruction, and life that they wanted to do something to try to redeem themselves. So they had this theory that the people who get kind of lost in the shuffle, that lose land, lose property, end up beggars and homeless and criminals in the streets of London and elsewhere, they're the victims of environmental circumstances rather than their own bad character. Quite a liberal idea, I like that. It's true, but I like that. And they convinced King George II that if you'd start a colony in the New World where every person who's done and out of their luck has a second chance to break themselves, it'll be a success. It's another city of money. And so they receive a proprietary grant for exactly that purpose, to set up a social reform colony. But they make life quite, also the king said, well, what's in it for us? I mean, the king didn't trust the people who are in that situation are going to make a better lot for life. Why should he support that? And the argument given back is, well, if the French and the Spanish in Florida decide to invade South Carolina, they'll have to kill all the Georgians first. So they'll serve as a defense buffer zone. So again, says, I like that. That's what you're looking for. Those are the kind of people we'd like to put against the buffer zone. So the colony was established, and it was a pretty Spartan life. They worked from dawn to dusk. They did not own their property. They weren't allowed to drink, gamble, and carouse in the evenings. They were supposed to meditate on what a better life they had. Didn't work. Most of them ran off. So it was a failure as a colony, and Georgia then was just opened up to whoever wanted to provide slave plantation land for the city. That's what he brought. And the colony I forgot to cover on the reverse sheet, so let's go back and do that. It's New York. So the one we were on before, I forgot to talk about New York as a middle colony. Originally, it was a Dutch colony established in the 1620s. What the Dutch tried to do in New Netherlands, as it was called before New York, with its capital at New Amsterdam, before it was called New York City, what the Dutch tried to do was transplant feudalism. They're not the only ones who tried it. The English tried it also. Penn, even though he was a Quaker and believed in equality, had a dream of transplanting feudalism to Pennsylvania. The proprietors of the Carolinas also had that. What this would mean is setting up fiefdoms with manor lords, with serfs for more. Every one of those attempts to transfer that social system failed for exactly what I said earlier. when you have a lot more land than people, people just run off, they don't remain service. But that was the original Doug's wish, to set up that colony. It failed, instead they made their money selling fur to the Indians and then shipping and buying and selling gold and slaves and molasses, et cetera, worldwide. In 1664, Charles II made another one of these proprietary land grants to his brother, the Duke of York. He said to the Duke of York, "See that Dutch colony over there? That's my gift to you for helping me come back to the throne." He says, "Well, how do I get it? Because you have the English Navy at these places today." So the English Navy was sent to New Netherlands to inform them that they're no longer a Dutch colony, but they're an English colony. The governor of the Dutch New Netherlands at that time, a man who can't spell it, Stuyvesant, had a peg leg and raced down to the wharf when the fleet showed up, expecting the citizens' committee to be right behind him, declaring that they would fight to the death to defend that New Netherlands from English takeover. Gets down there without hardly anyone behind him. They're all kind of like, "I don't know, not us." And a different deal was cut, being that as long as the Dutch can keep the property, they'd be glad to be in their English sovereignty there. No problem for them. So a peaceful transfer of authority made in Netherlands, New York in 1664. Later on, the Duke of York will become the next king, so it becomes a royal problem. So that's how the first colonies got started, but I'm still back on the second page here. I want to say a little bit about the differences politically, socially, and economically between our three regions. In the northern colonies, the New England and Middle colonies, people tended to want to live in townships and communities. So they would build a township and go out to the fields to work and come back and live in the town. And when enough people had a desire to live further away from town and start new farms, they would collectively move up and start new townships. So new communities would be designed and planned and moved at once, rather than people moving on their own. Totally different in the south. Southern colonies, it was people lived sparsely apart from each other, gathered personal land holdings without feeling obligated to be involved in the community. Landowning in the northern colonies and middle colonies was quite balanced, quite equal. The majority of people owned land, and there were very few large land holdings. In the south, it was quite different. There were huge plantation owners and people next to nothing. So socially and economically, there was more diversity and more equality in northern colonies than there were in southern colonies. Public schools arose in northern and middle colonies, primarily for the first public schools to make sure that everybody could read the Bible and be religious. So it's kind of a bit ironic today that liberals like me fight so hard to separate church and state. That's completely in defiance of the original reason of setting up public schools, which is to teach people religion. No public schools existed in the southern states until after the Civil War. And that's kind of intentional as well as just a natural evolution of things. The wealthiest people hired tutors and sent their kids off to foreign boarding schools, but there was no desire to have a public school system in the south because they wanted that oligarchic status difference between rich and poor. Here's something else that I forgot to mention. The major crop of the South Carolina was rice and indigo. So we need to know that. Again, tobacco in Virginia, rice and indigo in South Carolina. Cotton, not a prominent crop in any of the southern colonies until well after the Cotton Era. Item 11. As I mentioned before, each of the 13 British North American colonies in a vacuum, without help or without administration from England, set up their own local legislatures, which turned out to be quite democratic and representative. And so it was common for people to believe that if they're unhappy with local administration, they had a vote. Now, people in the north had more vote in the south because voting was based on property. But still, it was always that feeling that there is somebody directly responsible for mismanagement who we can vote out of office. And although the governors were appointed by colonial owners, the governor's salaries were paying for it and all that stuff. So there's a sense of responsibility there also. In voting, two requirements existed in all the colonies. Property ownership, certain minimum of property ownership, and membership in the right church, state-established church of that colony, for mostly that being. Do we have those restrictions today? Property ownership and church membership? Why not? Folks come at it another way. Why did they have that in those days? Is it an elitist system? They want to make sure that not everybody had a fair shake?
The people that were elected were more than connected to the church.
That the people who voted as well as ran for office represented the ethical values of the community, knew right from wrong, and if you were a property owner, you're likely to know a little bit about foreign business laws, you have a stake in society, you have a commitment, you aren't running off overnight. So we could say the people who were given the authority to vote were those who were educated enough to understand and have a commitment to society both ethically and financially. Is that what you meant?
Some of those people are not allowed to vote.
That's true. Figures don't lie with liars. No doubt the better educated know the better scheme. But theoretically, is it so wrong to have an educated society financially and ethically doing the voting? Then why don't we have it now?
In practice, it's not very representative.
It's true. In practice, it is not fair. It is not equal. What we're talking about is quality versus equality. And in this day and age, we prize equality over quality. Is that a comfortable thought? It is for me. I think that the task is, yes, guarantee everybody a voice and get them educated, as opposed to eliminate those you don't want. Those restrictions would last up until the 1830s, well after the Constitution was established. Okay, new topic. Mercantile laws. I mentioned that the two ways Charles II restored his debt was to give land grants, which we mentioned, New York, Pennsylvania, and Carolinas. And the other way was to bankers and merchants. He urged the Parliament to pass the first navigation law. Actually, the very first navigation law was passed in 1650 by the Puritans, but was tossed out, but then reestablished in 1660. So if you see a 1650 Navigation Act, it's almost subject-wise the same as what the 1661 period is. There's, again, the purpose of the mercantilism: keep the money in the empire. Try to not let your people buy foreign-made products, but instead sell them. Colonies work to try to supply all those products the home country can grow within its own empire rather than having to spend precious hard currency elsewhere. First law, 1660, included these provisions. All trade that would take place between the colonies and Europe must travel on English-made ships with the crew of at least three-fourths English or American. Because Americans are considered British too. So all the traffic from the colonies to Europe and vice versa is supposed to travel on English ships with English, mostly English American crews. That right there suggests that all the money made from the colonial trade will have benefit England first. Also added to this was something called a list of enumerated items, stands for the same number, which included tobacco, fur, lumber, and indigo. It would eventually include other stuffs, but fur, lumber, tobacco, and indigo. What this meant was these products grown in the colonies could not be sold anywhere but England. Not supposed to be sold to France, Spain, or any French or Spanish or Dutch Caribbean islands. it was not well enforced. None of them would be well enforced. So you have laws on the books, but lack of enforcement administration, and truly a lack of any enthusiasm among the Americans to follow it. In item 13, a second law, the 1663 Act, is passed. It says that all imports to the colonies and from the colonies now must go through England. Proper taxes or duties have to be paid upon entering an English port, but most of those would be rebated back upon leaving to show proof that they've been through. We'd have to understand that this particular Navigation Act was not followed, or otherwise there would have been no slave trade. It's impossible to imagine African slaves being moved climate to climate from Africa up to England, back down to the Caribbean, and back over to England, and back down to Africa. All that's just beyond reality. So the slave trade almost always defied navigation laws, which either meant that there was an exception occasionally given, or there were bribes given, or when caught, large numbers of slaves had gone overboard in the river to avoid getting busted. What the colonists would do is, instead of going to England, they would go to another English colony, the Caribbean or Virginia or something of that nature, get some kind of documentation they had visited that port, and then travel on, and if they got caught, they would argue we went to an English port system, which is not what was meant by the wording of the law. So the 1673 Act of Item 14 was passed, which required all shippers to place a bond or a down payment of money at the port before they left, which they wouldn't receive back until they had documented proof that they had been to England. It went unenforced also. So all three of these laws were ignored, and instead business was conducted with proper bribes, smuggling, and privateering. It's defined privateering.
Piracy?
Yep. It's fake piracy. Privateer would be someone who owns their own ship that would fit out on a given mission to fight a war for the Majesty's service. You'd receive a license, a letter of mark, which makes you an official temporary pirate in service of the crown. In theory, you'd go out and do enemy or battle with the enemy, capture their cargo, bring back the cargo, keep a small percentage for yourself, and then turn over the rest for the mob. In practice, what happened was, no fighting, like people would just go out and trade with the enemy, and then if caught on the way back in, they would claim they were involved in the struggle and getting killed. This is from the 1660s to the 1760s. This is the way American trade and shipping worked. And while they bribed local customs officials and governors in the ports here, or naval officials on the open seas, American colonists hired lobbyists to go to Parliament to try their best to not pass or weaken the navigation laws. So Americans were not allowed to send elected representatives to Parliament, but they had to pay lobbyists. And Ben Franklin was one of the best unpaid lobbyists to try to prevent more and more navigation laws. So as we see, from the beginning of the American colonies in 1607 all the way up to the 1760s, for a good 150 years, serious navigation law enforcement never really existed. One of the attempts by England to make it work is item 16, the creation of the Dominion of New England. It lasted from 1685 to 1690. And it coincides with the rule of James II, who's down in 19. Every time I retype this sheet, items 16 through 20 are shuffled around in a way that I think will make more sense, and then I always tell the story differently. So 16 through 20 will all get told somehow here. 1685, Charles II, who had come to power to win, not with 1660, after the interregnum of no king. So Charles II, who's king from 1660 to 1685, dies in 85. His brother, the Duke of York, who he gave New Netherlands to, ascends to the throne. He'll be King of England for 5 years, 1685 to 1688. It's a rocky ride for him. Here's why. Earlier in the century, James the First, Jamestown is named, he came from 1603 to 1625. James the First always touted divine right. That kings are kings because it's God's will. And members of monarchical families are born that way because it's God's will. And they are not beholden to the people, they're only beholden to the deity. Well, that was some of the source of the fight in the English Civil War. The Puritans had argued that this is not the case, that people have rights rather than monarchs. And so when Charles II did come back to power, he was tight-lipped about this divine rights thing. He was a believer in it, but he realized that the only reason they're back in power is because people got tired of the Puritans being such killjoys and pleasure. And so they didn't want to start enunciating how powerful they were. They were a little more cooperative and not servile, but respectful of Parliament. When James II, the Duke of York, comes to the throne in 1685, he's got that old James I attitude. I'm king because it's God's will, and I own all the property because I own all the realm, literally real estate. People will do what I want, and I don't have to do what Parliament wants. If I want to make taxes, I will. If they don't like it, they'll take it. So, James II is a much more dictatorial ruler. Then James II marries a Catholic. Of course, being a Catholic in England is always suspect, and that is the monarch marrying a Catholic. Then they produce an heir, which is baptized with the Catholic faith, and so is James II. So he's a Catholic, future heir to the throne is a Catholic. He's a tyrant, a monarch, and kind of associated there together. Papist, dictator. And that's too much for the people to tolerate. Part of, before we overthrow him here, part of that period from 1685 to 1688, there is a corresponding change in the colony. That's when the Dominion of New England is established. And James II does it on purpose. He's arguing that these colonies have been skipping around the law, not paying their taxes, not behaving themselves. They're going to make each other line. So he takes the governor, the colonial governor of New York, Edmund Andros, his name is here somewhere, 17, moves into Boston, combines New York with the New England colonies, and makes it one central authority unit, which it is wished and hoped would eventually become the central authority unit over all the colonies. Andros does the following things. He levies taxes without legislative approval. He demands that people join the Anglican Church, or at least pay taxes to the Anglican Church. That's insulting enough, especially the Puritans. And then worst of all, he has the audacity to fire those customs agents which enforce them. That don't enforce law, to take bribes. He actually is going to enforce navigation laws. So it's a poor small world. Taxes without recognizing legislative authority. Forcing people to pay taxes at the Anglican Church even if they don't believe in it. And making people pay these navigation laws and follow the law. All he was doing was enforcing the law. But people associate Edmund Andros's high-handed manner in the Dominion of New England with the tyranny of James II. So there's unrest in the colonies, as well as back in England. Parliamentary leaders, sick and tired of James II, contact a member of the Stuart family, Mary, married to William of Orange, and issue an invitation and say, if we depose James and invite you to come be monarchs, will you forever and all your offsprings forever recognize that you are responsible to Parliament, that you are not going to run the divine right stuff? They agree. The arrangements are made. James II catches the hint that he's soon to be out of jail. Kind of reminds me of Don Regan, where he used to be chief of staff for Reagan. Nancy wanted him fired. Ronnie never called him. He just found out Monday morning that someone else had been appointed to his job. Nancy got away. That's the way James II kind of caught him and things. And rather than end up with his head cut off too, he took off. And in a bloodless revolt or this coup called the Glorious Revolution, he was gone. So 1688, Glorious Revolution, significant for many reasons. And I'll run through a few of them and shut up here. It's the end of absolute monarchy in England. William and Mary do, as we're told, and so do all future monarchs of England. They are responsible in Parliament. And it is from this point onward work, the authority of the king starts to rapidly diminish, and instead the rise of prime ministers in Parliament. With news of James II's demise, Edmund Andros, it isn't long before he's overthrown also, by a rebellion that started in New York called the Leisler Rebellion, which actually failed, but the offsparks of that led to the overthrow of Andros in Boston. So the Dominion of England falls apart. People are happy again. They don't have to follow navigation law. They don't have to pay taxes to the church. Their legislatures are back living for taxes. So the essence there is that they're still not following navigation law. Item 20 is the significance. Enlightenment thinker and writer John Locke, who we'll say more of in a little while, looks at this glorious revolution of 1688 and puts together a philosophical political work called The Two Treatises on Government, published in 1690. He argues that the notion that kings own all the property and have all the authority is flawed, that in reality, every human being has certain rights, which include property rights, and that also includes the right to choose who will be their authorities, that the authorities are servants of the people, not the reverse, and that what happened in 1688 was in keeping with Enlightenment human rights principles. If people overthrew a tyrant to protect their right to choose who should be their leader. He conveniently left out the fact that a bunch of Anglicans and many Catholics are out of Catholic, which is probably good. And to make it even more of a hypocritical, Parliament, trying to make sure that that didn't look like that, passed what's called the English Act of Toleration. 1689, English Act of Toleration, declares you don't have to be a member of any particular religious faith to hold office. Wink, wink, if you're Catholic, not a lot. Also, in 1689, the English Bill of Rights passed, which is an update, a more modernized version of the Magna Carta. It is the 1689 English Bill of Rights that Virginia's Bill of Rights was based on, that Jefferson wrote, and later our Bill of Rights, the National Government was. So they're making hay out of this glorious revolution. They run off a tyrant Catholic, and they subject their monarchs forever to parliamentary authority. They establish a documented Bill of Rights. They establish to a certain degree a separate, not a separate church and state, but a non-requirement religious state, which we have in our Constitution too. Sixth article, we have something that says no tests, acts, or no tests for religious nature will ever be administered. You don't have to be of a certain faith in order to hold office. When we return, I can see the exhaustion in their hearts. Quiz, not ready for a quiz yet. Let's finish up the 40 and then we'll take a quiz overall.